The committee's in recess. The witness is former Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch. The key word there is former. She was dismissed by the president, which is not uncommon. But what is uncommon is that this dismissal came after a what's been called a smear campaign. Articles and various allegations, all of which she says were without foundation. In fact, one of the Ukrainian prosecutors who spread the rumor that she was inhibiting the prosecution of corruption has recanted because, in fact, she was doing the opposite. We called up Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation, to talk about how this situation is different and why somebody would think it was necessary to conduct a campaign like this against an ambassador instead of just simply removing her.
Well, we know because emails have since been declassified and shared publicly that it first started as kind of a mystery that these blogs, that these articles online started popping up mentioning her, alleging things about the ambassador, first in Ukraine, then picked up in the United States by some conservative media. And then you had Rudy Giuliani going on television in the United States, talking about her, tweeting about her. And that is where this moved from sort of a whisper campaign into an all-out assault. And the State Department officials around her were very concerned, saying, what is this coming from? And the allegations were that she was somehow corrupt when she was actually working on anti-corruption initiatives in Ukraine. So it's not unusual for a president to decide who serves that post, and you serve at the pleasure of the president. What's unusual is to be told that you're being removed not for cause, and in fact, not being able to have described to you what it is that you've done wrong or why you have become the focus of this assault. Someone who, in private testimony, Ambassador Yovanovitch has described this betrayal. She talks about serving the American people for three decades, and then in her moment of need, no one had her back. And she talks about that not just in a personal case, but she argues the entire State Department is suffering from that. And you saw this Inspector General report this week that described political targeting of lower-level officials. She would be the highest example of that, the highest office.
Well, the thing that's outrageous to me is the deliberate sliming of somebody who is innocent of these charges. If these are fabricated charges, I mean, it's one thing if a president fires an ambassador and says, "I'm sorry, you know, we're changing direction, and you'll have to go." I'm trying to figure out why this smear campaign would be necessary. Was this Giuliani trying to convince the president? He could have picked up the phone and said, "Look, fire her." Why would a smear campaign have been necessary?
It's not clear. What you've heard in testimony from people like diplomat George Kent, who spoke earlier this week, the case that her allies have made that because she was so effective in fighting corruption, that corrupt individuals came after her, but that those dots haven't been really connected in public.
I see. So that's what's at stake in this case today, that the president may have bought into a false smear campaign run by corrupt Ukrainians against an uncorrupted American ambassador.
This is an extraordinary case. I mean, it really, there was no other term for it. But we do know that the president often says he likes to trust his gut and to trust the people he views as loyal rather than some of the career professionals, the bureaucrats. Sometimes people refer to them derisively as the deep state. So favoring people you trust and their opinions rather than the record of service, for example, perhaps is not that unusual when it comes to how this White House functions.
Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. Her guests on Sunday will include House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Congressman Jim Jordan. I'm told they will not be seated next to each other. I'm not even sure they're going to be on at the same time, because I would make for a pretty good show now that I come to think of it. We get a movie review from Tom Tagney. It's a Netflix movie, also a Martin Scorsese movie, so it is a piece of cinema.
That's
they flew
right.
You down to Hollywood to see this?
They did indeed. Because it's a Netflix movie, Netflix came in and bailed out Paramount, which was getting nervous because it was getting so expensive. $140 million movie. Paramount said, hey, this is getting too expensive, Marty. And so Netflix swooped in. Well, Netflix, because they have a cable outlet that basically they want to show their movies on Netflix, they don't want to have long theatrical runs. Martin Scorsese insisted on a theatrical run, so what they did is they gave you, we get 2 or 3 weeks of a theatrical run, and then starting November 27th, you can see this movie on Netflix. So it's kind of a twist. So because of the fact that there's only a 3 week window before you can, see it on your TV set or on your laptop, that all the major movie chains will not show it. So all your AMC theaters, they're not going to show this. So they've had to negotiate individually with every theater that's going to run it. And so part of this is part of their outreach effort is they flew like 100 of us, you know, down there from around the country just to try to, you know, get access to this. I normally don't do junkets, but this is one of those things that was worthwhile. And by the way, Seattle, it worked out perfectly. It's playing at the Cinerama Theater and it opens today.
Yeah. It's so called The Irishman.
It's called The Irishman. Yeah, sorry, we'll get to it. And this is going to be a long review, but it's a damn long movie. I'll tell you about that in a bit. So, famed director Martin Scorsese has teamed up with Robert De Niro for the 9th time, Joe Pesci for the 3rd time, and Al Pacino for the 1st time to make The Irishman, a classic mob movie with a significant twist. The twist is not one of plot or character, but of tone. Ultimately, The Irishman is a reflective, almost philosophical mob movie. Now, that's not to say there isn't a lot of typical gangster crime, racketeering, smuggling, weapons trafficking, robbery, and standard high-energy gangster action like shootouts, violent assaults, and brutal killings. But in the end, it's a remarkably subdued look at the life choices that mobsters make. It's not the glamorous life that movies like to make it out to be. Regrets? They've had a few. The movie is based on the life story of a World War II Army vet named Frank Sheeran, who for decades worked as a hitman for the Buffalino crime family.
It was like the Army. You followed orders. You did the right thing. You got rewarded.
Mob boss Russell Buffalino also helped him become the right-hand man of the most powerful union boss in the country, Jimmy Hoffa.
Hey, my friend. I got that kid I was talking to you about here. I'm going to put him on the phone and let you talk to him, okay?
Hello?
Is that Frank?
Yes.
Hi, you Frank. This is Jimmy Hoffa.
Glad to meet you.
Glad to meet you, too, even if it's over the phone. Our friend speaks very highly of you.
Thank you.
I heard you paint houses.
Yes, I do, sir.
I heard you paint houses. In the book that this film is based on, it's called I Heard You Paint Houses. Sheeran claims to know how Hoffa died. By the way, the phrase paint houses is mob lingo for a hitman. When you shoot somebody and the blood splatters on the walls, that's painting a house. Jeez. It's Hoffa's demise that provides the dramatic focus for the film, despite the fact that Scorsese covers many decades both before and after that deed. He accomplishes that by opening and closing the film with Sheeran as an old man, reminiscing in a nursing home, and using flashbacks to tell a jumbled chronology of his life. Despite all the flashbacks, it's worth noting that this film is decidedly not showy. There are no standout examples of bravura filmmaking, and that's entirely by design. Scorsese says Sheeran was not a showy mobster. He was a matter-of-fact, do-your-job kind of henchman, and Scorsese chooses to portray his actions accordingly. The film's aesthetic matches its subject. That low-key aesthetic is on full display in perhaps the most extraordinary scene in the movie. An elderly Sheeran appears to be making a confession of sorts to a very earnest young priest. But rather than a typical Hollywood conversion scene in which a dying criminal desperately asks for and receives God's forgiveness for his life of crime, The Irishman instead turns it into a theological discussion about whether a lack of remorse and guilt nullifies the sacrament of confession. The film is clearly not looking for tidy resolutions, and Sheeran neither seeks nor receives one. The nuance in this scene alone may earn screenwriter Steve Zaillian another Oscar nod. As for the actors who speak Zaillian's dialogue, De Niro is excellent as the reserved, behind-the-scenes man Frank Sheeran, who swallows his ego to get ahead. Pacino is recognizably Pacino, playing the hothead Jimmy Hoffa. The sparks really fly between the two of them in a series of confidential, heart-to-heart conversations/confrontations. These particular scenes late in the movie are pure actor showcases, but they also provide the emotional fireworks as well. My favorite performance, however, is Joe Pesci's, primarily because he plays the polar opposite of his earlier roles in Goodfellas and Casino. His Buffalino is so quiet, so unassuming, so circumspect, even as he ruthlessly rules his crime syndicate, that it's hard to realize it's Joe, funny how, Pesci. That trio of great actors is aided by strong supporting performances by Scorsese regular Harvey Keitel, Ray Romano, Bobby Cannavale, and Stephen Graham. The film's length, at 3.5 hours, yikes, may prove a problem for some. I can personally attest to the fact that through circumstances out of my control, I had to watch it on a very hungry stomach, and my interest never wavered. I highly recommend seeing it in the theater while you can. It's playing at the Cinerama in Seattle. But if that's too much for you, it'll be available on Netflix on November 27th.
Tangs?
3.5 Tangs, Dave.
Thank you, Tom. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Every morning before I leave the house, I go wallet, keys, iPhone, glasses, watch. That's five things. Wallet, keys, iPhone, glasses, watch. Wallet, keys, iPhone. And it gets to the point where on the way to work, I'm constantly patting myself. It's actually kind of weird, and I've been wondering if maybe I have obsessive compulsive disorder. So let's ask Allie. Allie Sokolow, licensed mental health counselor, brought to you by ProClub, the Northwest Premier Center for Health and Wellness. It's called OCD, and that's when you just check things way too many times, right?
OCD is really about when you can't stop thinking about something, and so you have to compulsively do something to get rid of that thought process. So your wallet, iPhone, whatever system you have going on there, because you're thinking about it, you have to actively pat yourself down and make sure it's all happening or that thought doesn't go away.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of like a very mild version of OCD.
How do you know when it gets to be more pathological?
What we see with OCD is these, we call them intrusive thoughts. That's what's happening to you, by the way. Those are intrusive thoughts. There's a technical name.
Well, because it's happened to me. There are times when I've left without the iPhone, and then I'm off balance all day.
That's right.
I can't get messages. I don't see news bulletins.
That's right. So I'll answer your question by telling you a story. So I knew somebody who they had to do their radio station a certain way every time that they changed the radio. So it's not like they could go from like whatever's on number one station and go to number seven or whatever. They had to go from one to two to three to get to seven.
Well, that is crazy.
Well, I wouldn't say crazy, but and so the one time they did it differently, they got in a car accident.
Oh, my gosh.
So it reinforced that belief system,
right?
So here's something to think about, though. Were you so obsessed with pushing the numbers on the radio that you weren't paying attention and that's why you got in a car accident?
Yeah.
Right?
So it might not be just that the ritual was different.
That's right. And so that's when you start to see a problem is where rituals are preventing you from doing other things or they're causing you problems because you're not paying attention to what's going on around you. Hmm. That's an extreme example of car accident.
We call it a ritual. You mentioned ritual.
Yes.
I mentioned ritual. That implies that it's in some way not necessary, that there's a level of superstition there. I'm not checking my pockets because of superstition. I'm checking my pockets to make sure I have everything I need. You know, it's like making sure you've packed everything before a trip.
Yes. So there's two things, right? So you're doing it because you need all those things probably to feel like you have it all together.
I need my glasses to see.
Well, there you go. It prevents you from doing your job.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So that I wouldn't even say, I jokingly said mild OCD. That's probably really necessary things that you need during the day. Where it becomes sort of a ritual, what you're talking about, is where the association comes in of like, if I don't do this, something bad will happen.
Yeah, I see.
Right.
So there's some people, I think, who for example, wash their hands compulsively.
Yes. Yes. And that's sort of a germ thing, too.
Yeah.
And so it's like this really great fear of germs. And so I have to do this 20 times or I'm going to get sick.
There's a thing called feng shui.
Yes.
Right. Where your room has to be exactly a certain way.
Yes.
Can that kind of thing get compulsive?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. So what we look at as clinicians is when does it start interfering in your life? Are you constantly late to work because you have to wash your hands or check your door 20 times?
Yeah.
Are you not actually leaving your house because you're feng shuiing so much that you can't leave the house unless everything's in the right order? And hopefully somebody will sort of be able to address this or get help before it gets to that point.
Mm. But that's the line, when it is interfering with the necessary activities of life.
Absolutely.
What I do to protect myself, by the way, is have backup glasses in every place I intend to visit. So like here, in the car, upstairs, downstairs.
And some of that is really just smart planning, right? Like we can sort of joke that all of us have a little bit of OCD, but it's kind of like why I have phone chargers everywhere I go.
Yeah.
It's like, you know,
exactly.
Right? It's a backup plan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm responsible for about 15% of Rite Aid's net profit each year.
That's amazing.
Yes, I know.
You're going to be on the next commercial.
Exactly. Allie Sokolow, licensed mental health counselor. Thank you, Allie.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.